And one quick note before we, of course, get into Charles Pellegrino, because I'm looking forward to this. I love the supernatural stories. I really do. Just call your credit company. Also, that's an easy way. Call your credit card company and just tell them you dispute this particular charge. You didn't get what you believe you were offered. And there's a high likelihood you'll get your refund that way as well, or they just won't charge you. So go ahead and do that too. Boy, the credit card company's going to get jammed on that one. In a moment, we are going to be talking with Charles Pellegrino about the supernatural. There are a number of areas of expertise with Charles, so get ready for them. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Charles Pellegrino has been known to work simultaneously in entomology, forensic archaeology, paleogenetics, the preliminary design of advanced rocket systems, astrobiology, and marine archaeology. He's the author of 18 books, including Return to Sodom and Gomorrah, Unearthing Atlantis, Dust, Ghosts of the Titanic, Her Name Titanic, The Untold Story of the Sinking and Finding of the Unsinkable Ship. He's also the scientist. Now listen to this, whose dinosaur cloning recipe inspired the Jurassic Park series. Charles had made dives to the Titanic aboard the Muir submersibles, and together with Dr. Jesse Stoff, he formulated the theory that environments similar to the deep ocean volcanic zones might support life in subsurface oceans beneath the ice of certain moons of Jupiter and Saturn in what is often called the Europa theory. Many things to talk with Charles Pellegrino about tonight. Charles, welcome back to Coast to Coast. How are you?
Fine. Yeah, it looks like we might cover all subjects down on the bottom of the ocean and out into space, and sometimes simultaneously.
Absolutely. How have you been? It's been 4 or 5 years since you were last on Coast to Coast.
Yeah, it's been quite a busy time. Of course, back to the Titanic, and Basically, what I was studying at there was a kind of volcano physics. Things like collapse column downblast, things that we now study in volcanology, were first observed archaeologically in the wreck of the Titanic, in the certain way that the metal was bent by this column of water that descended with the Titanic and impacted the stern section when it stopped descending it. Up to 50 miles an hour, impacted somewhat like the Titanic stern looks, as you might imagine, a skyscraper if it had been impacted by a 50 or 60 mile an hour tsunami. So Titanic ended up being somewhat my baptism in archaeology about 20 years ago. So what a way to start.
You've got to tell us what it was like to make dives down to that ship. And I mean, that's got to be eerie all by itself.
It is probably the best commute to work on the planet, aside, you know, next, right up there with going up to the space station. To me, even though I've been down to the bottom of the ocean in these submersibles several times, given a choice, if I was ever told, look, you can go up into space once, or you can go back to the bottom of the ocean once, there wouldn't even be a moment of having to think about it. I'd be going back down there.
Did you get claustrophobic at all when you were doing that?
Some people do. The odd thing is I've had firefighters who survived 9/11 just look and say ridiculously that you're a braver man than I am. My father, who was claustrophobic, he would say to me, oh, you go down into those things, more power to you, you're a braver man than I am. And I look at my father cockeyed and say, wait, you were on the beach at Normandy, you were in the Battle of Veer. And so for me, I don't think there's any bravery involved. I'm just one of those people who doesn't get claustrophobic. I live and work sometimes in very tight spaces. So even though you're in the mirror and there's enough space, a little less space in there for three people than would be in a car such as the Volkswagen Beetle or the Mini, I just love it. My face is glued to the porthole the whole way down. And for me, the most amazing part of it is, the commute at least, is passing through this mysterious zone known as the deep scattering layer. It's the layer that on a ship's sonar shows up as bouncing signals back from about a a kilometer down or a little more than a half mile down. And that is where all the strange animals live. That is where one time when we were docked on top of a volcanic zone more than a half mile down, the zoo came to us. And of course, every time going down or up through the deep scattering layer where you see, every time you are seeing creatures that nobody has seen before. And my mind is always with the first person who went down into that half-mile zone alone, William Beebe. At the same time, my mind is very often with him, and actually I kind of envy even more than the two men who first walked on the moon, Michael Collins, who was out
who was
there
up
a quarter million miles away, orbiting alone above the moon, and was the one who actually had a time to just be at the window very peacefully, looking at and mapping the surface of the moon up close, where only three other people had, well, actually about six other people had orbited that way before.
Well, and I got to tell you, Charles, without the Collins, Armstrong and Aldrin never would have gotten back. You know,
right.
They needed him and needed him up there badly.
Well, you People often feel sorry for him. Oh, he didn't get to walk on the moon. And I wouldn't have minded being him. And I kind of envy the astronauts who, while the other two guys were down on the moon during those missions on up through Apollo 17, who had the chance, had the opportunity to just be with themselves and just to be looking and observing and taking in an amazing new world.
When you were in the submersible, how close did you get to the Titanic? I mean, was it like feet away or hundreds of feet?
Nose to nose. In fact, on September 22nd, 2001, we became the only three people I know of that actually went inside the Titanic. We weren't supposed to do that. We had an accidental... of all things, it's a can of Spam that almost got us killed. There was this famous can of Spam that had been Antarctica, that had been everywhere, and this guy, Big Lou, and I, we had signed the can of Spam down there, and he was posing for a picture. What a silly way to almost die. And accidentally leaned against the forward throttle while we were actually angled down and sitting on top of the Titanic's number one cargo hold, shining our lights down into the cargo hold to assist a robot that was down in there from the other submersible. And all of a sudden, Victor, he started screaming, our pilot, and could see through the porthole, wow, this looks like the inside of the Titanic coming up at me. Turned out, if you imagine the mirror as being somewhat an oblong basketball.
Yes.
And you imagine the Titanic's number one cargo hold as the rim of a basket. We were going in just barely fitting into that basket. And a number of things could happen at that moment with the possibility of imploding lights and so on. About three or four things could happen, all of them bad. We had, fortunately, Victor, the Russian submersible pilots are the most skilled in the world at that kind of work. They somehow seem to act as if they can feel as if the outer part of the sub is their skin and know within 3 inches where the skin of the submersible is. And so in exactly the position we were going in, he went into full throttle reverse and pulled us out. Any other, a matter of inches, we would have been stuck in there.
Stuck there. Yeah,
permanent residence with the people above trying to figure out how to get us out with Velcro or whatever. And the first thing that occurred to me was, okay, we went into full throttle reverse and that the actual maneuver that saved our lives at that moment without us really bumping into anything, the actual maneuver that saved our lives was the exact same maneuver that was ordered on the bridge of the Titanic that actually made sure no matter what the ship did, it could not steer that rudder, and it was going to hit the iceberg at exactly the angle it was aimed at the Titanic in. And so the maneuver that saved us was the exact same maneuver that almost 90 years earlier had put the Titanic down on the bottom of the Atlantic for us to be exploring.
How dark is it down there, Charles? I would guess it's pitch black, isn't it?
darker than the deepest mine shaft, except for the wildlife. And even down at the Titanic, we see, they were dubbed the flashing milk duds. Some of the wildlife glows very, very brightly. In fact, on that same dive, September 22nd, and I have a little bit of footage, we saw something that was about 200 feet above us that was shining as brightly as our submersible's flood lamps, and it was not the other submersible. That submersible had gone up long before us. There were no robots down there with us. It was just us waiting for the water column to be clear so that we could begin our ascent without bumping into other submersibles, for example. And I remember at first I thought, gee, that must be MIR-1. And actually on the video, I'm looking up, I'm going, hello, what are you doing here? And then you hear Lou, that's not us.
It
was intensely bright. And then it just flashed off.
There must be creatures down there that we can only imagine.
There are. On an early dive, that very same expedition, one of the mirrors was down to the starboard side of the boilers near the broken part of the bow section of the Titanic. And they observed a huge puff of smoke, something very big, almost as big as the submersible itself, as it was described to me, getting out of Dodge fast as the submersible approached the boilers.
You know, Charles, when you were down there, and I'm sure it's easy, what goes through your mind when you think of those people, those lost souls who perished on that horrible period?
Everything is going through your mind. In fact, your mind is on maximum overload. The only thing that I could compare to my first encounter with the Titanic, nose to nose on the bottom, that with the whole spectrum of emotions involved, would have been the birth of my first child, the birth of my children. And it's just a very, very mysterious place, especially around the stern. The stern is such a violently, violently torn up place. It went through forces more extreme than the bow section did. It doesn't look very much like a ship, what had once been a ship at all.
It's that bent and up and smashed?
It looks like a giant cockroach on the bottom of the ocean that had been stepped on by a giant foot. The only thing that looks as destroyed as the Titanic stern are things you've seen in pictures of parts of Hiroshima, where you could tell, gee, that sort of looks like it might have once been a building.
Yeah, but I'm not sure.
Flat.
Yeah.
The ruins at Ground Zero were very, very reminiscent of the stern. In fact, there was a scene along Versailles Street that reminded me exactly of what I had seen above me about a month before.
You know, in all the investigations that you've done, and you've been all over the place, I mean, return to Sodom and Gomorrah, unearthing Atlantis, the site of 9/11, Titanic. I mean, is there that one spot that truly has this very strange supernatural feeling to you, or is it everywhere?
There are two spots. You know, at Pompeii's Herculaneum, which is Pompeii's lesser-known sister city.
That was close by.
Far,
right? Yeah.
Far better preserved than Pompeii. Herculaneum is where you don't just find cast images or fossil images of the woodwork. You find the actual woodwork. It's not where you just find fossil images of a bowl of walnuts. You find the actual walnuts singed, turned partly to charcoal and still marginally edible after nearly 2,000 years. In a place like that, you're always aware that thousands of people died. In fact, in Herculaneum, the people who were within or anywhere near the city, they all died within the same 0.2 seconds.
And they thought they were immune to that eruption, right, for a while?
Yeah, a lot of the people who stayed, I mean, not immune, it was just that the dust was moving toward Pompeii. So there might have been throughout that first day of the eruption a feeling of, gee, this is bad and this is scary. but
we're okay.
Four people in Pompeii.
Yeah.
There is evidence of distress calls going out either from Herculaneum or from another city in the area that were received. All of this was written about by Pliny the Younger. It was received by his family because Pliny's uncle was an admiral who then brought a rescue mission into Herculaneum, toward Herculaneum and Pompeii. But they received either through torches or flag signals, because the signal reached them very fast, according to Pliny the Younger, that there must have been signaling towers along the road. Through a kind of Morse code, they very, very quickly received this signal, far, far faster than relays on horses could have carried the signal. And Pliny the Elder brought a small fleet to try to rescue. The message was, we need boats, we need boats to evacuate people. So some people in the area of Herculaneum who were not in the shadow of the falling dust, which was tending to move from almost 20 miles up in the atmosphere and falling in an easterly direction, some people in there, even though they weren't in the line of the pumice fallout, knew, gee, we have to get out of here, and we have to get out of here very quickly.
This cloud that filtered over Herculaneum, what was it like in terms of the heat and the temperature from it?
Well, Herculaneum had, from just before what would have been lunchtime till about between 12 and 1 in the morning. We can actually record what was happening with the volcano and exactly when it was happening, because we have the Pliny account that was actually preserved, because the Plinys were favored by the Vatican, so their accounts were actually preserved and copied and recopied. And so their story still exists. And given certain time markers that we have from the Plinys, we can look at the eruption phases that are in the ground and actually trace events physically, what was happening in the two cities, within an accuracy of about 15 to 20 minutes.
Did they vaporize?
In Herculaneum, the heat that reached the people in, for example, people who ran into the marina, they would have seen at 1 a.m. a surge cloud. We're talking about forces that are on a level with the most powerful atomic bombs ever developed. So what the danger with the dust is not what is raining slowly down on Pompeii and settling as almost snowdrift
right.
in those cities. The danger is when that jet of material, which is at some points throwing up at twice the speed of sound, jetting directly into the sky 20 miles into the air, the mass of about 10,000 tons a second.
Oh my.
Okay,
God.
Imagine the mass of 10,000 Toyotas every second being ejected at the stars, and it is mostly small rocks and dust. If there's an avalanche in this constantly being eroded and constantly widening throat of the volcano, if the side of the mountain cascades down into the throat of the eruption, well, then that engine's going to stall. And what happens then is that you have those 10,000 Toyota masses per second trying to collapse toward the ground. The effect is a dust-filled, imagine an atomic mushroom cloud, dust filled, but instead of the mushroom going up into the air, it is coming straight down toward the ground.
And what's the
and
temperature?
And then flowing across the ground once it hits the ground.
What's the temperature of that cloud, Charles?
Over 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit, considerably over that, more than five times the boiling point of water. What happened, what we can actually observe, happened in the marina where the people who saw this thing ran. At night, this would have been bright, bright red. It would have looked to the people like a gigantic tsunami, much, much bigger than what we saw in the past year that struck Sri Lanka and struck other parts that resulted in 250,000 deaths. Much bigger, much more spectacular, much more frightening than that. Imagine a tsunami hundreds of feet high coming at you. Bright red.
And this was a cloud. So stay with us, Charles. We're going to take this quick break. We'll pick up that story right from there, that bright red cloud. With our guest, Charles Pellegrino, I'm going to continue talking to him in a moment about what happened out there at Pompeii and also Herculaneum when we come back. And the next hour, we're going to chat a little bit about the very strange happenings at Ground Zero in New York on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Charles Pellegrino. Charles, these people who are looking at this red mushroom-type cloud coming at them, would they have even known what it was?
Well, it would have probably been preceded by whatever it was, probably a collapse of part of the top of the mountain that actually caused the eruption column to stutter and falter and then to have that upside-down mushroom cloud coming at the ground, which is many, many tons of dust and rock, each of those grains of dust and rock becoming a gravity current and bringing a slipstream of air behind it on its fall to the ground. So once it hits the ground, it's not only the mass of that material, a mountain of material that is now dust and air mixed together, it's the air that's coming down with it and blasting down behind it that is forcing it along the ground. So it moves more, you imagine it as somewhat a composite material, just as bronze is a composite of copper and tin, and it has the qualities of both, and you end up with a somewhat stronger blade. This material that is racing toward you, superheated, is more a combination of rock and air, and it behaves as a mixture of both, as a fluid, somewhat, in fact, almost identically as that the huge surge clouds that you've seen video of slamming through and flowing along the streets of New York City
right. When
the Twin Towers collapsed. Only get a measure of scale, 9/11, what New York City took that day was about 1/10 to 15% of a Hiroshima. Which is quite a lot. That is just the kinetic force of the two twin towers collapse columning and down blasting into the earth. Vesuvius in AD 79 was 1,000 Hiroshimas. And as far as volcanic eruptions go, that was still only a baby. In fact, it's one of the smaller eruptions from the Mount Vesuvius area itself.
Were people going along their business, or were they all, I know you're saying some of them were looking for boats and things.
Right.
But
on that particular day, they were, even as the eruption progressed, they were going along their business.
They'd look up
Pliny
at it.
Pliny the Younger wrote, he said he could not imagine. It sounds to me like the Edith Russell response, which we name after the woman aboard the Titanic who went back to her room and tidied up and made sure everything was neatly in the closets and the bed was properly made before she went to the lifeboats. This kind of nesting urge. Pliny the Younger writes, just as Edith Russell wrote years later, about how she could not imagine, and it's very strange behavior looking back on it from two decades later, Pliny the Younger said, looking back on Vesuvius, he could not imagine that he sat down with a book and was reading Livy as the volcano was erupting until a family friend from Spain walked in and said, basically, are you nuts?
I mean, they were just assuming everything was okay?
I don't think so. I think it's more a matter of the Edith Russell response is kind of a nesting urge to latch on to something near and keep an eye on what's going on, but latch on to something close and familiar. I experienced it myself.
But
after
she survived.
A plane crash.
But she survived.
She survived. Right. I survived in a plane crash. Okay, there were flames near me, and I'm assessing, but at the same time, becoming very concerned about a box of chocolate chunky candy bars where 120 people had just died around me. But I think that kind of response kept me from running in the wrong direction and running into flames. And just at the same time, you're dealing with something very close at hand, such as in my case, chocolate candy bars that I didn't want to see melting. You're assessing the situation.
Yeah.
Your subconscious mind is snatching in every bit of information it can from around you at a psychopathic rate and analyzing it. And then it's you very calmly go off, okay, I need to get at this way to get away from the danger.
Look, I don't want you to dwell too much on the pain, because I'm sure there had been some of this plane crash.
Well,
but when does this happen?
When these things happen, at the moment you're involved in a situation like that, it's much more, it's actually more painful for people outside the situation to look in on and imagine than it is for you actually in the situation at that moment.
Can you tell us what happened?
Almost exactly 30 years ago, I was driving a truck, which is what I was doing in the summer between semesters, and a plane, actually, it's interesting, it was caught in a microburst, which is a phenomenon that involves downblast and ground surge and the exact same physics that we're working with at Vesuvius and at the Titanic. It's where you just have a sudden downsurge of rain from a major thunderhead, the sorts of clouds that are often associated with tornadoes.
Okay.
And you have an area that's over 1,000 feet across where everything is, where the air is just being sucked down. And a plane came through this and lost lift at that moment. I was driving the truck that got hit by parts of the engine. At the time, did not know. It was about 3 hours before I really learned that I had been involved in a plane crash. I had suddenly the row of cars in front of me wasn't a row anymore, and I was coming to after having gotten a little bump on the head. The truck was not in very good shape aft of me, but believe it or not, it was still drivable. All around me was utter destruction. In fact, you could say that I ended up in one of those shock cocoon events where people around me and cars around me were, you know, mostly gone, and where I was just sitting there with no greater injury than just a bump on the head. I was in another plane incident. For me, and I guess for most of my family, we should really stay away from airplanes.
And I was going to say,
you would ask, do I get claustrophobic in the submarine? Believe me, I'm not that worried about the submarine. It's the flight to go up and meet the ship to go out with the submersible that I'm much more concerned about.
I'm flying tomorrow to St. Louis. I'm not sure I even want to talk with you about this, but I have to.
Go ahead. Actually, yeah, and don't be afraid if you're on the plane with me, because Arthur Clarke's theory was always that I'm the guy you want to be sitting next to on the plane, and if I get off of the plane, follow me.
Yeah.
There was a terrible, terrible event in my family in 1996 that actually got me to book off of a plane about a week before the flight, that I eventually ended up being called to and asked to do work on analyzing the crash. Nobody had survived, and I was supposed to be on that plane. I was on the Air New Zealand DC-10 that in 1982, in May of 82, lost all power coming across the Pacific. Pilot did an excellent job of recovering that plane. I learned later from other pilots that we were not very far from what is called structural divergence, where the plane is plunging so fast that it hits the sand barrier, passes through the sand barrier, which for a DC-10 is one of those things that's definitely bad.
In a situation
in the situation, in that exact situation, the strange thing is, and I spoke with other people afterward, you're almost outside of yourself watching it happen to someone else.
Yes,
that's actually the feeling. And the overriding emotion for me at that time, and I was not alone in this feeling, was fascination.
Just
there,
by
there
watching
was
other
no
people?
Pain. It was more fascination than anything else. There's this sense of unbelievability about it. And once I had that was the one situation in the Air New Zealand incident where I was 100% certain I was not getting out of this alive.
Now, is it quiet,
and,
Charles?
Once that certainty hit me, the fear was just not there at all.
Is it quiet in a plane like that, or are they screaming?
That is the amazing thing, the silence. There were occasional grunts, from bumps that we were hitting on the way down, bumps in the air.
But people are quiet.
The only person who let out occasional screams was the stewardess who had slammed things down on the floor and belted herself into the impact seat in front of me. But it was the quiet. And I remember there was a movie, it's one of only two instances where I just walked out to the snack bar and had to get away from the movie for a while. I think it was called Fearless.
Yes.
They had interviewed survivors of the St. Louis crash. And I was watching the movie, and one of the aspects that film caught during the plane crash sequence, and it's about a man who survives this and becomes somewhat of an action-adventure junkie afterward, and the silence. That movie actually captured the feeling of it. Now, then I became uncomfortable, and I had to walk out to the snack bar for about 10 minutes until I was sure that part of the film had passed, and came back to see the end.
And as this plane was headed down, and you say you're over the ocean?
Right, we were over the Pacific.
What happened? Did he get his engine started up again, or what?
Yeah, from what I was told, the pilots brought it into a somewhat steeper descent and managed to get all power back and restarted and recovered the plane. And you know that sense of fascination I had mentioned? After we were up and safely through this thing, and the pilot has said, well, we had a little bit of a problem there, but okay, she'll be right, mates.
Did people cheer?
I don't recall.
I know.
When we landed, people clapped.
Yeah, that happens
a
lot.
It was, there was a feeling of, that was such a roller coaster ride that if I knew in advance that I was going to get out of this without even a bump, my immediate feeling was, I'd almost have said, hey, let's do it again.
Did you have a religious experience at that point when you thought, this is it, I'm gone?
No.
You did not?
No.
No thought of what was it like?
There were people around me who I'm sure were praying. But for me, no, there wasn't that sort of an experience.
How about thinking about what's on the other side?
You think funny things at moments like that. And one of the things I was thinking is that, boy, I hate sharks. And deriving a little bit of comfort from the fact that, well, we would be hitting the ocean so fast that I wouldn't have to worry about the sharks.
You know, it seems like your career has revolved around these incredible, either Earth-like or man-made tragedies where you come across, I guess if you added up the victims of your research, we're talking about thousands and thousands of people who have died.
Yeah. In archaeology, I mean, you come across whole civilizations that have died. The island of Thera, and working at that place. And even though a lot of our work in volcanology, the volcanology aspect of it is, okay, how can we predict these things? How might we save lives in the future? Is it possible through thermal voltaics, for example, which is an emerging new area of engineering, to be able to learn enough that we can go to the Canary Islands and stop that eruption that is building maybe in another 50 or 60 years, and not only manage to prevent that eruption, but be able for a century or more to, with clean electricity, power the entire African continent while preventing a volcanic and tsunami catastrophe. And even though we're looking toward those things, yes, we are always working in areas where thousands of people, or in the case of Thera, the island that's now called Santorini, entire civilizations have been thrown off the rails, and the entire course of human history has been changed forever.
You wrote a book called Ghosts of Vesuvius. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that's the work that involves three places I've worked: the Titanic, Vesuvius and Ground Zero. And if you, for almost everybody except those of us who were out at the Titanic on September 11th, saw the pictures of the towers falling, and we were in a place where, in fact, we did not see any of this until we got to shore nearly a month later. The people who, if you looked at it and you thought how much that resembled the footage you'd seen of Mount St. Helens erupting or the Montserrat eruption, how much it looked like a volcano, if you had that thought, you were perfectly correct. The physics involved were identical. And in fact, that's the work I was doing at Ground Zero. It involved volcano physics. Going into one of the darkest places on Earth and just hoping that we can bring information out of there that in the future would save lives. And for example, in the Naples area, it looks like we are getting that yield out of the Ground Zero studies, because when you show people that this is what happened to people who were within a surge cloud at Ground Zero. And what you saw on film was every bit of video you've seen of those surge clouds is when the force of the cloud was already mostly spent. And the cloud was down to 5 miles an hour, or at most, the fastest I've seen, I've clocked at about 35 to 40 miles an hour. But that cloud emerged from each of the collapsing towers at a velocity of 120 miles an hour, approximately the velocity of the Vesuvius surge
so
in 1979.
If you were away from the building, but you got hit by that cloud at that speed, would you have been killed right away?
You would have been killed instantly. You would have had degloving injuries, which you see only in Hiroshima archive footage, in footage of people who were struck by tornadoes that are at F4 or power, the sorts of tornadoes that are referred to as the hand of God. What a degloving injury is if you recall the movie Terminator 2, where Arnold Schwarzenegger takes a knife and cuts the human skin off of his arm and just pulls his entire hand away as if it is a glove. That is what happened to people if they were not in some way shock cocooned or shadow shielded along, for example, West Street and Washington Street south of the Twin Towers. They had degloving injuries that involved their entire bodies.
If you were able to, let's say, hide around the corner of a building, might you have been safe?
Yes, and strangely, sometimes the safest place to be is nearest to an explosive event. So we have one Port Authority police officer, Robert Vargas, who is the sole survivor of the South Tower collapse column and downblast. He is an instance of a man who was in a shock cocoon and who then stepped out of one shock cocoon as it was evaporating into the other shock cocoon and survived a little bit bruised, but actually survived. Within 15, 20 feet of an area where the forces were up over 3 tons per square inch. Forces equivalent to, at 3 tons per square inch, that's approximately the pressure trying to get in at a submersible 2.5 miles down on the bottom of the ocean, and the submersible suddenly implodes. It's a force that shatters jade and diamond. And yet, he survived right in this area. There were other shock cocoon events near and around the Twin Towers. For instance, a restaurant in a building that was attached to the Twin Towers, half of a building disappeared.
Just
and
gone.
There were firemen who were in the restaurant, one of whom had a premonition that he'd somehow been through this before and he was never going to see his wife again. And he stopped in that restaurant with his team on his cell phone to call his wife to say goodbye 20 seconds before the South Tower collapse columned. And he was not very far away when he was trying to find a way out of the restaurant. He found the steel frame of the pool at the Marriott Hotel attached, which was part of the restaurant. But that pool had been minutes earlier, 20 stories above him. Yet when he looked around the restaurant, the glasses, the cups, the napkins, the table settings were still there undisturbed where he was. That's what a Shakatun event
Let's
is.
talk about more of those stories when we come right back, Charles. I'm George Norrie on Coast to Coast AM.